Today, a real deep perspective on crypto. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. I'm joined today by Caroline Bowler, the CEO of BTC Markets. Hi, Caroline.
Hello, how are you doing?
Yeah, very good. And how are you doing?
Yeah, really good. Looking forward to the end of the year, I think, like lots of people.
It's been quite a year, hasn't it? But we need to have a conversation about crypto. And, you know, there's some stuff going around in the media that is sort of saying, oh, it's all going to fall apart. It's the end of the crypto revolution. I actually think it's a bit more complicated than that. So I thought I want to get your perspective on what's happened with FTX, what it means, and more importantly, how we should be looking at the broader agenda around crypto and Bitcoin and how it plays out into the future.
Yeah, all really good, meaty topics to get into, I think.
Good. Well, let's start then with FTX, right? So there was this massive collapse in the US. We had FTX Australia also falling over. 30,000 Australians roughly suddenly found that their savings weren't safe. And of course, all of the media coverage was very much on the people who put superannuation funds into it and people who'd actually put their house into it, et cetera, et cetera. Why did FTX fall over? And is this typical of crypto? What do you think?
FTX fell over for the very reasons that we've seen other Ponzi schemes and, you know, other kind of nefarious activities, you know, in traditional finance. And it's a tale as old as time. From what we can see, from what we can understand until, you know, the final audit and stuff has been done, but from what we can make out, they were taking client funds and using them for their own ends. And they were putting them into a fund that they were running. And seemingly for some reason, which we're all baffled by, that fund couldn't make money in a bull market, which is really remarkable for crypto. And the fraud was uncovered. What's really interesting, or one of the many interesting pieces about it, is how shockingly bad the coverage has been of this in some areas of traditional media, in particular in the US. The CEO, Sam Bankman-Fried, SBF as he's known, had prior to that been a media darling, which is fine. But it seems as though that role has spilled over, even though now he has done something that is knowingly criminal and that isn't really up for debate, the criminality behind what's happened. And he's been given airtime in major, like the New York Times is gave him airtime to appear on their deal book conference to try and somehow catch on like he's an innocent party or didn't understand what was going on or some kind of justification for what transpired. There's no justification for stealing client funds. There's no justification for that. There's no explaining your way out of it. But that seems to be what's transpiring now. And it's very puzzling how this is being allowed to happen because everybody else in the crypto world is very clear about what's happened. The crypto media, and to be fair, the media here in Australia in its reporting hasn't followed that narrative that we're seeing out of some other major titles. People have lost everything. This is a crime with some seriously affecting its victims. And for some reason, it's just not being treated in that way. Sam Bankman-Fried is not being treated as the criminal that he is. And that's really quite shocking for me sitting here anyway, and I'm sure for others in the industry too, why this is being allowed to happen. His, I guess if he's on a PR tour to sort out his reputation. So that's shocking. And I can imagine if I was one of those people who lost all my crypto because I believed in this person, I would be disgusted by what I'm seeing and how they're trying to, I don't know, repair his reputation or give some justification or some excuse for what he's done. I don't know. It's really, it's baffling. And I sit here and say this as somebody who went through the GFC. I was a minor cog in the GFC wheel. I wasn't a big part of it at all, but I was a bystander who sat and watched while greed undid for so many people what was so important to them, particularly in things like housing market and so on, and the devastation that wrought across most of the developed world. And to see the same kind of casual attitude towards those kind of activities then transpire into crypto is just really heartbreaking. But I think too then for exchanges such as myself and the one that we run and other exchanges, I don't know, no other, this is the thing. There's no transparency between exchanges. So you can't be sure what's happening unless you're looking at an exchange like, for example, Coinbase, because that's a listed exchange on the New York Stock Exchange. So they have to publish results and they have to be audited. They have to meet the same standard as others. But for the rest of the industry, we don't know who's swimming naked, as they call it. I can only stand over the parts of the industry that I can control or have some view on. And, you know, I think that the fact that I worked through that GFC and saw the need for the risk management controls and rigor. In the absence of any regulation in Australia, we adopted that posture anyway. And so now with all the requirements and things that are going to be coming forward, you know, we're comfortable, we meet those anyway. And I'm comfortable with the positions that we have taken when it comes to risk management. Nobody wants to talk about risk management when it's in a bull run. Nobody wants to talk about decisions around, well, why do you only have X number of tokens on the exchange? And why don't you offer us margin? And you know, all these different kind of, I suppose more, the only reason we didn't do it was because of the licensing requirements around margin, for example, the infrastructure that you need to build out around it. Why we didn't offer those sheer number of tokens to different products is either we need a financial license to do so, or, you know, we weren't comfortable with those particular projects. That's why we didn't list them. It wasn't rocket science. We didn't do anything special or different. We forsook, you know, forsook is a very traditional word, but we said, okay, we'll sacrifice the potential revenue to stay on the right side of risk management. And I'm not saying that, oh, we're so great or, you know, anything like that, but it was more that I just don't want to be the person that has to ring my parents and say to my mom and dad, yeah, I've lost all the crypto, or you've invested in me. I had to make that phone call when I was in Singapore during the GFC, and I was the banks, there was a run on the banks, and I could see what was going to happen, and I knew that by the time my parents woke up in Ireland, the banks, there'd be a run on the banks in Ireland. And I can remember ringing my parents early in the morning their time, late at night kind of time frame, and saying to them, this is what's going to happen. You have to get your money out of the banks because I can see the contagion. It's like the whole thing is blown up. And I never want to have to do that with again. You know, I never want to ring my parents and have that conversation with them about cryptocurrency or anything that I'm involved with, in so much as it's within my control to do so. Go ahead.
Yeah. So let's just sort of stand back slightly. So FTX was way more than an exchange. In fact, yeah. The problem was that it really wasn't an exchange in the sort of the normal sense of the word, right? So whilst it was in theory a place where you could trade and exchange currencies and what have you, most of their activity was actually doing other things, and particularly cross-investing and cross-leveraging, a whole bunch of cross-relationships that were actually not transparent, firstly. And secondly, of course, the regulatory framework was very limited. So there were SEC, you know, people talking about concerns, but not really very much happening. But the regulatory framework it still is pretty much missing. Yeah. And the third thing is, of course, everybody at the time was very much on the, it can only go up. So it's worth just bearing in mind what you just said about the GFC, right? You've got to be asking the question, what if? What if it's not going to always go up? How does it work, right? And nobody asked those questions. And in fact, the guy who's now taken over as the CEO of FTX said he's never seen an organization so badly run, such little information, such little controls, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, and the point you've made, not everybody is necessarily in the same boat. So there are other exchanges that are much more legitimate. And as you say, you've got significantly more focus here in Australia. But again, there's no regulation in Australia, is there? So it's down to the individual businesses to be able to actually put the right elements in place. And I guess there's always a bit of a sort of a, well, if it's such a buoyant market, do we really need all those controls?
That's exactly the time you need the controls. That's exactly the time when you need the controls. Experience has taught us that. History keeps on teaching us the same lesson, and it's a question of when are we going to finally start paying attention to it. I think the buoyant market can cover over a lot, and we've seen that in traditional finance as much as we've seen it in crypto. It is appropriate that people will be asking questions, and they are asking questions of their exchanges or whoever, or their brokers. I mean, because that's another really important point too, right? Is that there's no distinction currently in crypto between a broker and an exchange. Yep. And it's the both are completely entirely valid business models, but both are different on the most fundamental part, which is where is your crypto? And the Australian trend is to keep it on exchange or on the platform. If it's in a broker model, your broker doesn't hold your crypto. It's the exchange that they buy it from that holds the crypto. So you need to be asking your platform, where do you buy your crypto and where do you hold it? Because if, you know, we've seen these instances that happen where, even with FTX, where people thought that they knew it was safe and it turns out it wasn't. And certainly for us, we've seen it, you know, like I'm very comfortable with the position that we've taken and have taken historically. I'm very okay with doing things like audits and though there's different controls and tests, that's all completely fine for us. You know, for us, the issue now is about trying to find an auditor who is available to do a crypto audit. That's the issue for us because there's so many coming all at once. We're all asking for the same limited number of resources, but we'll get there. That's fine. I'm not concerned from our point of view. Mike, what I want to see on the back of this is that it will cause others to pull up their socks as well. People who are, you know, no bad intentions, but just maybe are a bit lax on some of this rigor. And maybe this experience will force their organizations to write, you know, to raise their own standards. We'll do the same. You know, we'll do the same. But if there is one silver lining from it, let that be it, that you know, people really start to focus more on risk management and the risk management around their investments, as they should do. And that's, I mean, that's, you know, as you know, Martin, like we've been talking about regulation in this space for the longest time, And it's always been about proportionate and appropriate regulation. It's let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. The important thing with this is that the problem wasn't crypto. The problem wasn't Bitcoin. The problem wasn't Ethereum. The problem wasn't blockchain. The problem was very, very human. And it was a failing of human controls in an organization, overwhelmingly taken over with greed. And that's where we need to look at the regulatory piece. It's not about regulating Bitcoin. You know, that's not what's caused this issue. And I think that there's been a conflating between this experience and the rest of the crypto ecosystem. And that's, you know, it's not a valid position in my view. I am absolutely fine with people being cynical about crypto or don't like it, don't want to be involved in it. That's completely fine. It's a valid position to take for anybody once they've done some education around what it is. And this isn't education as in, you know, if all you're hearing is overwhelmingly positive and or overwhelmingly negative, there's generally a line somewhere in the middle where the truth sits. And that's, you know, if you can find that nuanced point of view on subjects and then decide, yeah, it's not for me, well, that's a different thing as opposed to deciding either end of those extremes would be my view, Martin. I'm open to being wrong, of course, but that would be my view.
Well, you know, it is interesting because there have been some people who have basically written the death throes of crypto and Bitcoin and say it's going to, you know, disappear completely. And of course, the value, you know, has dropped dramatically from what, $3 trillion to, you know, a significantly smaller number now. But there is some stuff at the heart of what crypto was trying to do which remains as true as ever. You know, the concept of the blockchain, the concept of the Bitcoin, and those things still have a level of underlying truth attached to them. What happened was that the commercial overlays that were thrown over the top of them actually aped the old world. It aped the world of mainstream finance. In fact, many investment banks and many speculators were using precisely the same techniques, the derivative techniques, the cross-leverage techniques, as in the old world, which is a really interesting observation, because what it actually says is it's more to do with human behavior and greed than the underlying technologies and the underlying philosophy of you know, Bitcoin or blockchain. What I'm concerned about is that a lot of the reporting is just saying the whole thing should just be folded up and thrown away, right? There's a kernel here which is really important and still provides potentially a liberating path for finance into the future. And that's what I'm interested in sort of exploring and directing the conversation to, because there is still a valid story about a financial system that is devolved and decentralized and isn't controlled by central banks who've stuffed up majorly in their own right through the monetary, you know, interest rate cuts and then now the rises. There is, I think, a very important conversation to be had about ensuring that we don't, as you say, throw the baby out with the bathwater. But unfortunately, there are people around there pulling the plug out and just hoping everything disappears.
I think that it's quite right that, and quite human, that people take positions and then it can be and become quite entrenched in those positions. And it can be quite hard when there's points of view being challenged. I'm open to being wrong, but not because you just think it, but because you can prove it. And I don't think that what we've seen with Bitcoin or decentralized finance, I don't think it's far too early to be either way on it, to be honest. I don't think it's what to talk about decentralized finance for a second. This got lost somewhat in the melee because of what happened with FTX and took over. I was actually in Singapore for the Singapore FinTech Festival, which is a week experience very close to my heart. I was in Singapore for the first of them, was there in Singapore for a number of years. And for me, it was almost like a bit of a homecoming in a way, going back to that experience. And it was wonderful. And such a great collection of minds and people come together in community and exchanging ideas and learning about what's happening in other parts of the world. It's fantastic. What also happened that week was announced that JP Morgan had participated in the first decentralized finance transaction for a bank. They were involved with, I think it was with MAS out of Singapore, and also I think it's SBI out of Japan. They created a decentralized, I suppose like a CBDC of the Singapore dollar, Japanese yen, and then they also simulated two bonds, a Japanese government bond and a Singapore government bond. And what JPM managed to do was the transaction flow between the two on the currency side and also on the bond side. They did it through a protocol called Aave Arc. So Aave is a borrow lending platform in decentralized finance. And they created a bespoke pool of traders who all come from institutions that were all went through AML KYC. So although you may be blind to the people in the pool, a bit like the dark pools in traditional finance, they may be blind to their AML KYC. You know that they have been tested to the standard to be in this pool. And they actually can facilitate AML KYC can also be done on chain using verified credentials, which is set up by the W3C group, which is the World Wide Web Consolidation, I can't remember quite the phrasing of it. It's basically a coming together of international bodies from all over the world and institutions all over the world to agree a set standards to do with the internet. So it's not just decentralized finance, it's the whole kit and caboodle of the internet. And they have created verified credential standards that they will now adopt within decentralized finance. And this is what JP Morgan used and is part of this experiment. Where this is important and this is significant is that we've now seen JP Morgan, whose CEO has been so absolutely adverse to cryptocurrency, now participate in the first decentralized finance. B, it's a company like JP Morgan, an organization at JP Morgan with their standing in the market. And they have been, to their credit, they've been very forward looking in all this decentralized finance. They see we're also looking then at decentralized AML KYC. I got an email today to tell me I was part of the Medibank crowd whose data has all been sent out on the internet. So the idea of there being decentralized KYC that you control as the user, the holder, that you can put out on the internet or take it back again as is needed, as opposed to creating these honeypots of data for attackers to go after. That's a very compelling point, number C. But D, we can also see that they're willing and interested in coming to the table. They can see the opportunity around decentralized finance. So on one hand, you've got people saying, it'll never work. And then on the other hand, you've got major organizations putting time, money, and reputation on the line to participate. And I'm sorry, but anyone who's ever worked in banking knows that banks don't do anything unless they're pretty sure it's going to make a profit for them at some point, because it has to get through so many different committees in order to actually, participate. So it's those little things that give a little glimmer of hope. Of that, the most exciting part for me is the fact that they've got eKYC. The fact that you can now do KYC on-chain within that DeFi world, because that's been one of the biggest hurdles that people are struggling with, is like, how do we do KYC? And that's, as you know, that's so important within banking. Like, you can't not. So now we have a solution on chain, and one that is controlled by you, the individual, or you, the organization, rather than relying on us to do anything. So for me, it was really, really exciting. But again, a story that was somewhat lost, because at the same time, then we had...
Well, unfortunately, that is the key, the case. Everybody sort of runs over there and misses the other stories. But it seems to me that what we're really saying is that there is still a very important place for better education and better communication about this whole ecosystem and what it means and what the opportunities might be. And a lot of the conversations have become myopic, I think, and are really missing some of these very important architectural points about the fact that you can do things differently, and you can perhaps get away from centralized data and centralized entities holding that data, which actually would be a good thing rather than a bad thing, right? Because at the moment, actually, centralized data is, well, it's open to hacking and all those sorts of things, and it gives a lot of power to the people who hold the data. So in terms of empowerment of individuals and how they can potentially manage their finances into the future, that seems to me the sort of conversation that is worth, explaining, because that really is where this story should go. It's not about highly speculative investments on, a particular coin or indeed, being attached to multi-level marketing so the people who get in early are the ones who make lots of money and everybody else doesn't. Mm. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about here is a different model of the way finance might work in the future. And that seems to me where the conversation should be going.
Yeah, and I would agree with that fully, because particularly when you think about, there's no reason on earth why I should have to give copies of my ID that are then retained by other organizations, and anyone in that organization to a degree, would somehow justifiably find a way to access it. People don't need to know my birth date. People don't need to see a copy of my passport. I just need to be verified that I am who I say I am. And then after that it no longer holds any purpose. So why can't I take control back? Why do I have to leave it on, with these organizations? Why can't it just be like a zero knowledge proof or something similar in that regard to confirm who I am? But it's a very different way of thinking about finance, a very different way about thinking about our place in the world. Yep. And instead, it's more about that individual control. That is a shift in society that is not quite there yet. That really does dismantle some of the existing structures in our society, and it's going to take some time. And by the same token, it's also completely valid for people to feel this is a little overwhelming. I'm not comfortable with this yet. There's a lot of changes, and what does it mean on chain and so on? Completely valid. And when I talk to people then about, what's the role of a centralized exchange like the one that I'm on versus a decentralized exchange, of which there are many. My view is that for some people, there is a degree of comfort still to be had from working within that centralized framework. there's a degree of comfort with knowing that there's a human in, you know, that you can talk to, or that there's a human that's responsible. When you're talking about DeFi or DAOs and so on, there's still, I think, a journey to go on for people to understand what that's all about and change those mental structures as much as any mental structures as much as anything else. And it's all still so very, very new. It's almost a bit, you know, that was a bit that kind of struck me when looking at some of the reactions from people within the crypto community who are like, oh, you shouldn't have left it on chain. You shouldn't have left it on exchange. You should have done this, and this with it. That's fine if you're like with it and have got your, you know, your ledger and you've got all that stuff and you're very comfortable with all the phrases and all that kind of thing. Not everybody is. Some people are quite intimidated by that. And there needs to be a place. There needs to be a place to for those people, a way in for them into crypto without being told and kind of admonished for not being up to date with all the latest and the greatest things. For some people, just buying a dollar's worth of Bitcoin is as exciting as it's going to get for them, and so it should be. You know, we shouldn't be. That's the last thing we should be doing is excluding people because they don't feel comfortable with the technology to that end. But I think that's it too. Like some of the stuff I'm reading that have come out from regulators worldwide or international bodies worldwide, and they talk about how, oh, just because something is regulated doesn't mean that it's been, you know, approved, if you like, which to me was quite breathtaking. And like I'm as conservative and risk averse as the best of them, but the thoughts that I needed somebody else, some external third party, to give me an approved list of where I could invest or approved list of technology that I was allowed to use, I found that quite breathtaking and almost a bit laughable, because you're going, I'm an adult making my own decisions. You don't get to tell me an approved list. Just because it's like, I expect you to license it, but not for the sake of a license. I expect you to create frameworks that mean it's a safe place for me to invest. And after that, get out of the way. After that, it's up to the individual what they decide to do. And I'm not a libertarian, but the idea that these external bodies somehow could tell me what I could and couldn't do, I found that quite laughable. I just think didn't think it was realistic. But that's another thing when we talk about regulation and appropriate and proportionate regulation. What we can see, and we take the FTX example as a case in point. So let's say in Australia, we're in a scenario where, you know, a ton of regulation gets laid on the industry. And I'm not saying this is it, but let's just put this as a scenario where there's so much regulation that gets placed on the industry that it squashes out the local ecosystem. And creates a situation where it's very challenging for the Australian ecosystem to participate or, you know, flourish. It doesn't stop people from trading in crypto or being engaged with crypto. It just means that they'll stop doing it in Australia. And instead, what it means is that we end up exporting the issue overseas. So we export it out of our jurisdiction, out of any kind of protection that they may get here in Australia, and instead say, good luck. And, you know, we don't like it. So you got to do it elsewhere, because you're not going to stop. And we saw that, you know, case in point, the US, when they tried to ban alcohol, look how that worked out for them. You know, and it's, I'm not sure I compare cryptocurrency with it, but my point being is that you can't go around doing this to humans and think they're not going to react. You can't do that. You can't train baby adults. And so I think it's really, really important then that for us here in Australia, that we don't decide, to overextend our reaction. And instead, you know, we've got to create a safe place for Australians to participate in the crypto, you know, economy and the crypto communities, but, you know, not to the point that they have to do it overseas. It's just doesn't make sense. It's also not good for the economy, but that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah, so there's two final observations. The first is, of course, there will be those who will say, oh, well, you know, the crypto thing failed, but central bank digital currencies are the future. And guess what? There are nearly 90 central bank digital currency pilots running currently around the world. And, of course, that's the old world trying to impose old world thinking into a digital environment, with all those controls and all those, well, I can use those tools for monetary policy. And, you know, there's a paper in the US from the Federal Reserve saying that gives us extra monetary policy tools. Whoopee. Well, I'm not sure that that's a good line of argument. The other thing that will happen is that the degree of regulation that governments will try and impose, particularly in crypto, will probably be an overreach. And again, it will be old world thinking. So my concern is that because a lot of people who are making these sorts of decisions have a particular lens that may not be well informed, and also potentially informed by a long history of centralization and centralized control and top-down control from, you know, the IMF down and whatever else, this could actually turn out to be a really bad thing, because the very essence of what decentralized finance ultimately could be and should be could get actually strangled in the process. And that's the sort of dilemma that I see at the moment. And I'm probably as worried, if not more worried, about the central bank digital currency story and how that's taking shape without, frankly, a lot of consultation with ordinary Australians or any other country. You know, it's all top down from the IMF and the central banks and their pilots. In Australia, of course, we've got a central bank running a retail central bank digital currency pilot with a whole bunch of academics and a whole bunch of other, industry players, but actually very big moneyed industry players with agendas. And yeah, that is not fully understood.
There's a variety, from what I understand, although I haven't spoken to the project directly to understand, but I do know that there was a very large number of responses to their request, to their pilot program request. And to the point that, you know, I suppose naively hopeful that there will be a greater degree of engagement. I haven't gotten a sense from any discussions or interactions I've had with the team who are involved in that CBDC work that there is a huge appetite for one here in Australia. I don't really get that feeling from them. Instead, I feel like as though they're going, okay, you know, we've seen work happen out of Singapore, we've seen work happen, say in Sweden, we've seen work, you know, other countries. You know, there's a point to be made for us to do some research of our own. From the discussion, I didn't kind of get a sense that there was an enthusiasm to start rolling it out anytime soon. Because I would agree with you, like, this is a pretty major thing. It needs to be treated with kid gloves and caution. You know, this is the big time, folks. Like, we need to be doing this appropriately. But equally, we cannot be sitting as a country, like, you know, we can't look at our sovereign currency being, you know, eroded, particularly looking at things like soft power, right? I mean, we've spoken before in this program about soft power, yep, looking at the China, US, you know, the hegemony that's coming out of the US. Like, we've got to play a role, and that may be a part of the CBDC, but whether it's retail, wholesale, how that's going to be structured, there's a whole lot of thinking that still needs to happen around that. And it is part of this societal shift that's inevitably going to come around. Because when we talk about decentralized finance and we talk about, okay, trying to regulate out of existence, not that I'm suggesting that's what we're trying to do in Australia, but if that were to be a scenario, it doesn't get rid of the situation. Like, I will still be able to access it if I have a computer or an access to the internet or, you know, my mobile phone. I can get onto DeFi. I can participate in that DeFi world. And you cannot shut it off unless you want us to become like North Korea, where you can turn off the internet at will. And I don't think for one second that we have a civil servant force that wants to do that. But that's the kind of degree that we're talking about here. And I just don't think that's where it's at yet, she says with naive hope. But that's just not the impression that I get. And I think too that, like, I think that Australia and Australians in general are nothing if not pragmatic. I think there is a very strong sense of pragmatism in the Australian mindset. I think that that likewise, and amongst the civil service, it's the same, that there seems to be, a sense of common good that people are working for in Australia. But I still get that sense of it in Australian society. That may not be necessarily the case in other parts of the Western world at the moment, but I still very much get that sense of that here. So I do think that there will be more of an open mind, perhaps, you know, looking at some of these, you know, from both sides, as it moves on and evolves past what this will turn out to be a definitely a very low period for where we are with crypto at the moment. But you know, it's darkest before the dawn. And I think that there will be, from a risk management point of view as well, I think this will be an important turning point for the industry. And we'll still be here. You know, we're still participating in it, and we're still hoping to create a place for people to participate in it and talking to people about it, more importantly, and the benefits that there are to come.
Well, I appreciate your time today, Caroline, and particularly your forthright views and very balanced views. But I think that's really important, right? Because, as I said, I felt that a lot of the conversations that I was hearing around the traps were very myopic and very one-sided. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on one hand, there were risks, but on the other hand, there were opportunities. And maybe in the new year, we can, you know, have another conversation about this, because I actually think there's a whole big conversation to have, right, about how this plays out, and particularly in the current environment, and as we get hearing more about FTX. But, you know, my message today, and I think probably we're aligned on this, is baby in bathwater, we've got to be careful, right? Because we could actually end up in a pretty bad place if we're not careful. On the other hand, there's still opportunity if we know how to drive that opportunity in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't have said it better, Martin.
Thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.